We call ourselves Ilapushnisate. That's us. We drifted down here years and years ago. We wandered around all over South Florida.
Immigration has become an issue with the development of strong nation states.
We find people down here before us, they were Indians, and we thought they are funny because they had their own ways, and we don't get along too well with them. So we chase them off. And
I think of the people of the Southeast historically as the balls on the table after the cue ball has hit.
I heard they were leaving, spotted in the West Coast. They built a bunch of canoes.
Just breaking these tribes, sending them spiraling across the Southeast.
And they tied together and drift away towards west. This is years ago.
There's still Timucuan Indians hiding out in the Jacksonville area. They don't dare tell anyone that they're Indians. A gentleman who goes by the professional name of Silver Fox said, oh, they're not extinct. I know some. They're still here. I said, what the heck are you talking about? What did they say to you? You don't think we would tell anybody we're Timucuans, would you? And, of course, this would be great news to some of your historians, that if true, that they are survivors of the Timucuan tribe and culture.
Contrary to the immigration myth that everybody came here to settle and stay, the reality is that they return in rather healthy numbers, 25, 30, 35% left.
This is A Common Path, a documentary and debate about who Florida's people are and who we're becoming. In the introduction, you heard Buffalo Tiger, former chief of the Miccosukee Nation, political scientist Lynn Leverty, ethnohistorian Pat Wickman, Stetson Kennedy, and sociologist Max Castro. My name is Yvonne Lipke, and I'm a cracker who immigrated from Tennessee when I was 5 years old.
The white men give them nickname, Seminole, the words of wild people. And then Spaniards give us the name, Miccosukee. It's what the Spaniards have called us. We have forgotten who we are.
Until we began to actually set boundaries that stayed more than the length of time that the king was in power or whatever.
Lynn Leverty.
People moved back and forth with great regularity, and that they would not be able to do so was just not an issue.
There is no real prolonged peaceful moment in the history of the Southeast from 1565 forward,
Pat Wickman,
because of the struggles for territorial dominion among the Spaniards and the English and the new United States and the Native Americans.
Government always seems to be trying to confuse us and trying to tell us what we are.
The official policy of the Native American groups historically has been no integration. They believe very, very strongly that they have to maintain their cultural identity by maintaining control over their population and integration. The reality is that sex is sex no matter what color your skin is. And if two human beings find each other, they're going to find each other regardless of any law or any border or any military policeman to the contrary.
Before the American Revolution, the Spanish had a small military contingent clustered around St. Augustine, and that was basically it.
Historian Mike Denham.
So the large numbers of Anglos that came were fairly threatening to the Spanish.
The Spaniards didn't just want land or resources. They wanted a labor base, and they wanted souls. They wanted everything you were.
Government always seems to be trying to tell us what we are.
When the British came into Florida in 1763, they tried to get their own colonists to come, but very few people were interested. In fact, the English had to adopt all kinds of special enticements to lure people from Britain or other parts of their empire into East and West Florida.
I shall now say something about the most advisable method to be taken by immigrants who intend to transplant themselves into this part of America from the more northern region.
Stetson Kennedy reads from the journals of Florida surveyor Bernard Romans.
It is absolutely necessary to carry at least 1 year's provisions in flour, maize, pork, and beef. If the person be able, I would advise him to purchase Negroes in the northern provinces and to carry a few more than he intends for his own use. The profits on the sale of 4 or 5 would nearly defray his expenses.
Ex-slaves had been moving into Florida for almost a century by that time. The Spanish king had given them refuge, provided that they become Catholic and usually enlist in the military.
Carry no white servants unless you have in mind to colonize a large tract of land, and this has never yet been turned to account.
So by the turn of the century, 1800, you probably got maybe 1,000 Anglos. You had a lot of illegal migrants who came from the north, much like illegal migrants come from the south today, from the Caribbean into Florida, what I call acquisition by infiltration. The crackers would have been the more lawless element. They would have been the ones who were coming without special permission.
These crackers are nomadic, like Arabs, and are distinguished from savages only in their color, language, and superiority of their depraved cunning and untrustworthiness. Manuel de Cespedes, governor of East Florida, during the second Spanish occupation, June 20th, 1790.
Stetson Kennedy, are you a cracker?
Well, you can't really answer yes or no. You must take into consideration, you know, who's saying it and to whom and with what intent, as well as not a slur or a compliment.
If we assume that it's a compliment, are you a cracker?
Well, of course.
The crackers basically emerge from Scotch-Irish stock.
Florida was really a difficult place to homestead. Malarial, low-lying areas, hurricanes, alligators, mosquitoes.
Historian Ray Arsenault.
And it's not surprising that it only attracted people who probably were not willing to try the more normal channels of pioneering.
The people I refer to are really what you and I understand by crackers, persons who have no settled habitation and live by hunting and plundering the industrious settlers. Letter to Georgia Colonial Governor James Wright, August 20, 1772.
They were very hardy. They had very violent tendencies. They were very intolerant, for example, of the Indian way of life. They considered that it was their mission or their duty or their right to subjugate the wilderness to their own benefit. They were the quintessential frontiersmen. These Americans would come into these regions, which were very sparsely populated, and soon become so numerous that they would outnumber whatever Spanish might have been there, and before long they're declaring their independence from the Spanish.
All kinds of soldiers of fortune and pirates and all kinds of characters moving across the borders.
What I call acquisition by infiltration.
One president said the United States needs Florida like a body needs a foot.
In fact, at one point in northeastern Florida, around Amelia Island, where I grew up, became the center of the illegal slave trade.
Because of slavery, southern states insisted that it be written into the Constitution that the federal government would not play any role in immigration.
Political scientist Lynn Leverty.
Until about, I think, 1808, at which point it was up for grabs.
In the 18-teens, the port of Fernandina was the busiest port in North America. More than 400 ships a year.
Historian Ray Arsenault.
An enormous illegal slave trade, and Florida became a place of strategic importance. And the Spanish, of course, were on the verge of losing their entire empire. Both regular and irregular forces were sort of pushing the issue and helped to trigger at least the First Seminole War, and helps to bring about the annexation of Florida as a territory in 1821.
I recommend to the Spanish inhabitants of this place, Pensacola, I have found these people much more orderly than the Americans who are here. I do not believe I ever have seen a more moral or better people. They can be easily governed if treated with kindness and confidence. If the President and yourself will second me in my efforts, I think you will soon see a happy union among the people of Florida.
Territorial Governor William Pope Duval, writing to U.S. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, July 17, 1822.
Eventually be three Seminole Wars.
The Americans wanted land. The Indians had it. There were Americans moving into Florida. There were Indians already in Florida. There were blacks running into Florida as fast as they could looking for refuge. And they were all trying to occupy the same space at the same time. According to the laws of physics, that can't happen. And it didn't. It was a messy business for the United States. Over 3,000 of the Seminoles were finally removed from Florida forcibly and transported to the area that we know today as Oklahoma.
The words of these Seminole songs are, "They are taking us beyond Miami. They are taking us to the end of our tribe. They are taking us to an old town in the West." And We are going with George Washington. Which boat do we get in?
There was a very small number, possibly as few as 200 to 300, who remained in Florida. The United States quit fighting. No treaties, no definitive solutions, no definitive agreements. They just left, and they decided that white settlement would fill Florida and that the Seminoles would die in the Everglades. They didn't. They lived. They survived. They are still here. They are one of the great anthropological and genetic miracles of this whole entire process. They're still here.
Ethnohistorian Pat Wickman works for the Seminole Tribe of Florida.
It may be that the biggest thing we have to learn from the Native Americans is the ability to be who you are and accept other people for who they are without having to give up what you are. The European immigrants set their world up as an either-or. Either you are for me or you are against me. Either you are a part of me or you are my enemy. And the Native Americans didn't set their world up that way. I believe that this flexibility was the key to their survival for the last 400 years.
Florida has had basically two routes into it. So really it's the confluence of those two streams, I think, that defines the state.
Sociologist Max Castro of the University of Miami's North-South Center.
One has been from southern states after the War of Independence and the Civil War, etc.
We're talking about just a few hundred people during those days. These were just tiny villages.
Historian Ray Arsenault.
A few forts, of course, that emerged during the Second Seminole War, like Fort Harrison, Fort Brooke.
And there's also a route from the south. People from Cuba, the Bahamas, and many other places have settled in, for instance, Key West.
In about 1937, I was collecting folklore in Riviera, Florida, fishing village. And the Bahaman conchs had come over from the Bahamas on fishing trips and eventually sent for their wives and children and established this community on Lake Worth adjacent to West Palm Beach. I asked them what their status was as to immigration authorities. I said, well, we've been here all these generations and no one ever asked us anything.
These people were the founders of some areas of Miami, like Coconut Grove, for example. Florida is a late state to be settled by the United States, by Americans. And so you have this phenomenon that some people that migrated from outside the United States have actually been here longer than the so-called native population.
After the 1842 Homestead Act, a few homesteaders came into areas like Hillsborough County, the area that's now Clearwater. We're talking about a real raw frontier.
The Crackers are certainly the predominant ethnic and also cultural group that made up antebellum Florida.
Cracker historian Mike Denham.
Many of them became cowmen, not cowboys, cowmen in South Florida.
In Kissimmee they tell of old M. Bone Mazel and the stranger who died on his hand.
These people were not the poor whites that we oftentimes deride. Independent kind of lifestyle, determination to maintain that independence, free of government restraints. These are the traits of the cracker culture and are still very pervasive in Florida today.
He said, gimme one fare from Kissimmee to Vermont. Ain't this corpse going far? So instead of the Yank with his money and rank, who'd been round and seen lots of fun, I just dug up Bill Red and I sent him instead. Poor old Bill hadn't traveled round none.
1845 would become a state. Florida remains sparsely populated, but a very large proportion of the population is African American. As of the beginning of the Civil War, 48% of the population of Florida was non-white.
Anthropologist and novelist Zora Neale Hurston, recorded around 1938.
Oh, come on, run along, won't need no man.
as late as 1860, the entire population of the state was smaller than the population of Baltimore, Maryland, 240,000 people. Which suggests that even though the numbers of immigrants, of ethnic minorities, were small, they could have a real influence. Even one family could make its mark. There were 2,000-odd Cubans born in Cuba, in Florida, in 1880, initially almost exclusively in Key West. And all that changes in 1886, when Vicente Ybor decides to move his cigar factory from Key West to Ybor City.
The manufacturer had left Cuba and come to Key West to get away from the labor unions and higher wages.
Stetson Kennedy.
And of course, the unions came to Key West, too. And so the manufacturers again moved, this time to Ybor City in Tampa. And, of course, the unions followed them there.
And, of course, that begins the great Latin explosion, both demographically and culturally, in West Central Florida. Both Ybor City and West Tampa emerging as kind of polyglot Latino communities with mixtures of Italians and Spaniards and Cubans.
By and large, the Italians conform to that model of immigrants who leave their homeland and establish a new life in a new place.
Anthropologist Susan Greenbaum of the University of South Florida. Musicologist Anna Cheritakis translates this song from Milan, Italy.
Mama, don't make me beautiful for marriage. Mama, give me 100 lira, for I want to go to America. Go ahead, my daughter, and may your ship sink to the bottom of the sea.
Cubans were very busily engaged in seeking independence of Cuba from Spain, and their intention was to go back to Cuba. This was a sojourn rather than an immigration. After independence, conditions in Cuba were not particularly favorable. It was a war-torn economy. Independence from Spain did occur. The independence from the United States was much postponed, however. So the sojourn continued.
In this Cuban revolutionary hymn, the woman from Bayamo can hear her homeland crying out.
Tampa would not have been the city that it was, the largest concentration of cigar factories probably in the Western world, an enormous part of not only of the economy, but of the whole cultural mix.
The mutual aid societies formed by the Spanish, the Italians, and the Cubans were societies where medical care of a very comprehensive nature was available to all the members. They also engaged in cooperative buying. They developed systems where people would pool their money to mortgage houses, and I think there are some very strong lessons in the way the mutual aid societies were organized for contemporary managed care in the medical industry.
By the 1890s, from total wilderness, Florida is actually becoming a place where immigrants are moving in, mostly attracted by the railroad magnates, both on the East Coast and the West Coast. And for every railroad mile laid, they received a bunch of land, and they said, we have to use this land in some way, and the best thing is to attract immigrants.
The late 19th century migration was dominated by Canadians, Germans, Northern and Western Europeans, classic old immigrants, quite a few Swedes,
Dutch people coming in here.
They put the red pepper in the South Fork Trout and the vinegar in the beer. Oh, glory, glory, glory. What makes you so unkind? You sent me on to Germany and left for snuff behind.
People from Southern and Eastern Europe who come to dominate the immigrant streams after 1885 across the United States came even later to Florida.
Dios Marie, mountain flower, sung by Nuniki Simuri. Oh, my sorrowful calamus, my little mountain flower, your mountains are turning black. Oh, the flower of your manhood are departing. Your pride and joy, they are leaving. Oh, my eyes are heavy. I raise them up to heaven. Ah, the bitterness of my heart, I'll soothe with an opiate.
There are only about 7 or 8 spots in the world where sponges grow, because the sea has to be A, salty, B, not too deep, C, sun has to come in at a certain time.
Historian Lazarus Larry Ojack.
And the word got around islands like Kalymnos and Simi and Kos and various others in the Dodecanese, that there is wonderful water. You don't get the bends by going in very, very deep. The market is wide open. You can simply come in and start gathering sponge and making some money. And indeed, within a year or two from one Greek and his 3 brothers, you have between 2,000 and 3,000 Greeks.
And of course, the Bahaman conchs were already sponging in the area of Key West by means of grappling hooks.
Long handles with a hook at the bottom. The handle could be perhaps 20 or 25 feet long. And the people who were hooking the sponge were also called hookers. In Greece, fellows gather sponge by putting on one of those rubber diving suits and the typical helmet that you see even today in Tarpon Springs, with a glass front and sides and a umbilical cord like a hose from the top of the helmet all the way up to the boat, into which they pump the air to the poor guy down on the bottom of the ocean. However, you have the Key West hookers, and they absolutely abhorred this whole thing with the diving suits coming in. And in fact, there was a sponge war, not a shooting war. This was more of a paddle and chain hitting war, you see. But when hookers and divers met offshore, the hookers simply attacked these divers, trying to cut the umbilical cord, trying to get these people away. You had an environmental side also.
And the conchs alleged that the diving shoes of the Greeks were destroying the young sponges.
The boots probably spread a lot more spores than they stomped out.
The conchs set fire to the Greek boats, and the Greeks got out in something of a hurry and went on up the Gulf Coast of Florida to Tarpon Springs.
Greeks are not looked upon in Tarpon Springs as foreigners who are undesirable, but they did live separate.
Steve Zambellis sings and translates his song, The Boy from Kalymnos.
And as the boat is getting ready to leave the docks of Tarpon, you can see his eyes are crying. All the sponge divers go through the same thing in the Aegean Sea or in the Gulf of Mexico.
You know, blacks certainly have to live one side, Anglos on the second, and Greeks on the third.